Well, hello there, it's Antrice, and welcome to another episode of the Savvy Painter Podcast.
The number one thing I've been hearing over and over again since starting this podcast is that artists feel isolated. There's no one to ask when they get stuck on their paintings. No easy access to other artists who know what it's like and can give advice on the nitty-gritty stuff, like which medium works best for a particular technique or where to go for a certain resource. Since I started the Savvy Painter Podcast, I've been asking listeners like you what your biggest struggles are. And here are some common replies. I'm feeling the pressure to get some work done. I feel all alone in it sometimes, and I want to connect with other artists who understand what I'm going through. Another artist says, I struggle with having enough time to do everything and be everywhere at once. I know it's not a reasonable answer, but there are so many shows, competitions, and residencies that to sort through which ones are the best for career advancement, it's a career in and of itself. Or this artist who says that my family tries to be supportive, and they really are, but they can never understand how hard it is. I mean, you have to be an artist to really get that. So I kept hearing these same frustrations over and over again, and for a long time, I didn't do anything about it. Artists kept telling me that they need an ongoing mentorship, somewhere they can ask questions and get guidance about what to do next. That's why I created the Savvy Painter Growth Studio. It's an ongoing program for artists who are dedicated to honing their craft and learning to paint well. It's a community that supports each other, shares freely, and throws in a little bit of tough love when you need it. If that sounds like a program that you can thrive in, applications to Growth Studio are now open. Go to savvypainter.com workshops to learn more or to apply. Casey Zavaglia is my guest this week. Casey creates embroidered portraits of close family and friends. After 9/11, like many of us, Casey realized that the most important thing in the world is family, both the family you're born into or the family you choose to surround yourself with. That idea has fueled her work for the last 17 years. Casey lives in St. Louis now, but grew up in Australia. Her last show explored how our definition of family changes as we mature, move around, change countries, and create new families. Casey received a grant from the Regional Arts Commission in St. Louis to go back to Australia for this project. That grant allowed her to track down and reunite with her childhood friends and continue her work exploring ideas of family. In this episode, Casey and I talk about what she discovered, how she creates her embroidered portraits, and how the portraits have now brought her full circle into painting again. Early on, Casey reached out to the artist Chuck Close to get feedback on her work. Casey tells that story and how it impacted her afterwards. We also talk about the messiness of being human and how she plays with that idea in her work, how her kids have impacted her art and her career, and how she still sometimes has that fear that she's going to mess everything up or wreck a piece, and most importantly, how she deals with that. Please enjoy this conversation with Casey Zavaglia. Casey, welcome to the Savvy Painter Podcast. I'm excited to talk to you today.
Thank you. Me too.
So you do, just to give people a really quick overview of what your artwork is, you paint portraits with embroidery, I guess is what you could say. So really detailed, embroidered portraits of people. And this is a story I'm sure you've told before, but for the people who haven't heard it, how did you go from your kind of typical art into these embroideries?
Well, the short story is I was trained as a painter and studied painting in undergrad and grad school. And then about a year outside of grad school, I got married. And then the next year, I got pregnant with my daughter. And so around that time, I was really wanting to change. I wanted to stick with portraiture. I still wanted to portray people that I knew and my own family members. But I was looking for something new. And so getting pregnant forced me to have to create a non-toxic studio. So it was kind of like the two worlds collided at once. I kind of wanted to change, but then I was also forced to change. And so I gave myself a whole summer to experiment, really came up with nothing. And then at the end of the summer, the only thing that kept tugging at me was this piece I had done as a kid, an embroidery. And there was just something about that piece that had stayed in my mind. My mom still had it folded up in a closet. So I asked her to send it to me. And I thought, maybe I would try sewing a portrait. My first attempt was a smaller version. And so I realized that you had to scale up based on the scale of the thread to the scale of the portrait. But I was really coming at embroidery because I'm completely self-taught, even though I dabbled, you know, with embroidery as a kid. I really was bringing everything that I learned in school from painting to this medium, which was really exciting for me. And I would have to say, like, I've been doing it now for over 16 years, and the medium is still exciting to me and the potential that the medium has.
So you still have a lot left to explore.
Yes.
That's exciting. What size do you work at? What size are these?
So when I first started, they were just under life size. And because the medium was new, because the technique was something that I hadn't yet figured out, each piece was taking me about 6 months. And now that all my kids are in school full time, and I also know the technique, and I know how to get on the go quicker. So that same size portrait takes me about 6 weeks to do. But I've also, last couple of years, I've done some smaller ones. Originally, I was going to do some miniature portraits, but when you would get to sew the eyes would go in weird directions. So again, I realized there is an appropriate scale based on the type of thread that you're using. So I had to scale up to more like 6x4 inch size or sewing area. So now I kind of play back and forth, you know, between those two, as well as I also do paintings of the backs of my embroidery. And I've loved, like in the last couple years, being able to introduce painting back into my work, because I still think of myself as a painter. I still look at primarily painters for inspiration. But because I've been sewing for so long, I just couldn't find how to naturally bring painting back into my work. And so painting the backs of these pieces was just the perfect fit for me.
And when you say painting the backs of those pieces, you mean you're making copies of those? That sounds awful to say that you're making copies of them, but you're reproducing what's on the back side of it onto a painting, right?
Yes.
And do you do that with gouache, or what are you working with?
So initially, just to try out the medium, I did a couple gouache. They weren't even studies because they took me a really long time and they were very detailed. So initially I did some gouaches, which was the first time I'd worked in gouache, and I really loved it. But I was having my first show at the Contemporary Art Museum here in St. Louis. And to challenge myself, I thought I want to go really big so that the work has a presence next to the embroidery, because the embroidery it's very unique in that I haven't seen that many people use embroidery in this hyper-realistic style. And so they command your attention just because of the uniqueness of how they're created. So I wanted these paintings to stand on their own. And I felt the best way to do that would be if they were large, which is kind of, I always say it's getting into kind of Chuck Close territory because it's this giant head. So I constantly also had to wrestle that. How do I make these not look like Chuck Close? How do I make them look like they're very much connected to the embroidery work that I'm doing?
And what was your resolution to that?
Well, there was a lot of trial and error, which was frustrating and also exciting. So I had to realize a mark. You know, I'm used to working with something that's 10 inches away from me and imagining what it looks like from a distance. But now these marks, when I would walk across the room in the painting, they were just gone. And so what was exciting when I started doing embroidery was seeing how my history in painting played into my embroidery. So I couldn't obviously mix a color that I would see. So I had to develop a way of sewing that was maybe layering stitches that from a distance resonated as a color that I couldn't mix. And so I found myself kind of dotting in my embroidery, almost in this like pointless style, to create the illusion of these colors. So when I started painting, so I hadn't painted in 10 or 12 years, I found myself doing the same thing. Like clearly I could mix the color I was seeing, but I found myself dotting. And so I decided to really emphasize this influence that years of embroidery was going to have on my painting. And so I went to the craft store and got like different sizes of hole punches and created these stencils that I then scraped the paint on. So some of these dots were 4 inches wide down to 1 inch wide. And I loved it because they actually did the same thing from a distance. When you'd stand back from the painting, they actually somewhat disappeared. But when you got close to the work or 10 inches away from the work was really fun to see up close. Like there was still something interesting there paint-wise to look at.
Right. That's a fascinating translation. Yeah. And I think your work, when I see it online, it's the kind of work that you you want to see all work in person, but this is the kind of work that you absolutely have to see it in person, I guess. And in the best possible way, I will tell you that looking at your work online is really frustrating because I want to see it. And I'm like, okay, road trip, here we go.
Right. Well, actually, I just closed my show in New York and I heard from several people, either they made a comment on Instagram or just people who came to the exhibition who had been following my work online. And that's what they said to me. It was really fun to see the work in person. The work is really difficult to light because obviously they are still somewhat flat, but you can't just put a spotlight on it like you would a painting or something like that. But if they're lit correctly, which they were in this exhibition, there's something about the wool. It's different from paint. For instance, one of the portraits had, my friend had this green lime yellowy scarf on, and then her shirt was black. So when I stitch that shirt black, it's the deepest, deepest possible black because the wool just sucks in all the light. And yeah, just to experience them in person is definitely different. Plus you're also kind of wrestling with this urge to want to touch them.
Oh my God. Yeah. That must be so hard.
So yeah. So that's kind of fun to see the way people interact with them in person.
Kind of reaching their hand out and pulling it back like, nope, nope.
Yeah.
That's funny. How do you choose your subject matter?
So my work is all about family. Actually, through grad school, I did some friends and family, but I started this body of work when I was pregnant. I was thinking a lot about family. It was also around the time of 9/11, which I felt like, you know, when there's all these concerns in the world and then 9/11 happened, everything just went shh. And the most important thing in the world was family and love and the people around you. And so I decided to really go with that as the theme of my work. And so, yeah, that's all I've been doing until this most recent show in New York. For the past 16 years, I've only done aunts, uncles, cousins, my kids, my husband, nieces, nephews. And this recent body of work in New York was only portraits of friends of mine from my childhood of growing up in Australia. So I always felt like I told this kind of story of the second part of my life, but hadn't documented these people from my childhood. So because my work's about family, I really started thinking about how the definition of family has changed over the years and how when you think about immigration, you know, my parents immigrated to Australia in 1972. I was one, and we lived there until I was 13. And so, you know, the face of immigration it has many different faces and looks different for everyone. But the underlying thread I feel that every immigrant experiences is that you know no one, you make friends, and then those friends oftentimes have to take the place of family members. So they're the ones who invite you over for Christmas. They're the ones who take the place when you need a grandma or grandpa to come to your school. And so I really wanted to stay true to this core of my work, which is about documenting my family, and really kind of thought of these portraits under that umbrella of family.
Yeah, that really resonates with me because, you know, like I felt that pretty deeply when I moved to Argentina, lived there for 6 years with my husband. And now it's the reverse where we're here now. And so we've both gone through that exact same thing of just, I guess, yeah, being uprooted. I was trying not to say that, but I think that's the best way to say it, you know, and not in a bad way, but it's just.
Is your husband from Argentina?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
So he grew up in a small town, lived there his whole life. His best friend lived two doors down. He has a very, very tight network of friends and all of their kids call him uncle and they call me auntie. And, you know, so really strong, strong bonds. And, you know, the same thing for me, like I was born and raised, my mom still lives in the same house that I was brought home to. And I traveled a lot and I went places for long periods of time, but my home base was always like the Southern California, Los Angeles area. So to go for 6 years to somewhere else and suddenly be in this new place where you're just like, I think what I learned was how much I took all of that for granted, what it meant to that level of comfort and that safety net that you don't think about all the time. And maybe don't notice it, but when it's gone, you're like, whoa, I'm on my own, for sure, on my own.
Right. And I think too, like for me, I know now that I look back on my childhood, like growing up there, you know, the sights and the smells and the sounds of Australia is so connected to my childhood. And I think making this body of work made me appreciate those friendships that I still have to this day. And, you know, some of the portraits were of my friends' kids who are now grown up or young kids. So it's just really neat to reflect back and see that these people, how important they are in your life, which, you know, maybe you didn't realize at the time living there. So, yeah, it was a real honor to be able to do their portraits.
Oh, yeah, that sounds amazing. And how did you actually do it? So did you go back to Australia and gathering the reference material, for example?
Right. So in 2015, I applied. St. Louis is great in that there's a lot of significant monetary awards for artists. So this one was through a place called the Regional Arts Commission. And every year they give $20,000 scholarships to artists of all kinds. So that includes dancers, choreographers, writers, painters, sculptors, musicians. It's amazing. So in 2015, I was awarded a $20,000 grant, and it's literally you do whatever you want with that money. And so for the longest time, I'd wanted to go back to Australia. And because I was a mom with four kids, it was important to me that I brought my kids along on this journey. So the trip to Australia with my whole family took every bit of that money. And I just kind of set up appointments with friends, some of which I hadn't seen in years. So you can't just go right into a photo shoot. You have to like say, let's meet for coffee and, you know, catch up and feel comfortable. And then, okay, let's do this photo shoot. So I've been holding onto these images until this exhibition, just because I didn't want to pick away at the work and make a portrait to send to an art fair and then make another one to send someplace else. It was very important to me because many of these people are either related to one another or they know one another. So it was important to show them all together as a family in New York. And some of my friends who were in the exhibition actually came to the show, which was really special. The whole thing took from 3 years from start to finish. And I didn't get everyone done. So I might have like a batch two of these portraits.
And how many did you do for the show?
I did 10. So I did 10 and they were just under life size. So my last exhibition had a mixture of verso paintings and some smaller embroideries and then a couple large. And the larger ones definitely have a different, more powerful impact. And they also give me more area to work and kind of do what the embroidery can do in those areas. So yeah, I just kind of made the choice to go all big with this exhibition.
Nice. What was some of the more memorable reactions to the work from people who were there looking at it?
Well, I did two that I put on pedestals, which is always, people find that really intriguing to see this other side. Traditionally in embroidery, that side is always hidden. If you're a real embroiderer, it's supposed to be really neat. And I love that mine is not neat. It's knotted. It's very haphazard. And there's a really different feeling on this back image. So it's almost like a privilege to get to see it. But because only two of them were on pedestals, you had to kind of imagine what the other ones on the wall, what those back images look like. So that was kind of fun to see some off the wall and some, you know, still presented.
What do you think is your most biggest challenge with the work that you do?
Well, the challenge previously was trying to get enough hours in the day to work. But that's when I still had some kids at home and some in school. Now they're all in school. So pretty much I designate like 9 to 3 as my studio time. And, you know, closer to a show, I will obviously put more hours in. But yeah, I think just
The biggest challenge is getting the time in with the balancing the family and the time.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that is so common. But I think what's interesting is a lot of artists talk about the fact that once the schedule, this sort of imposed schedule that they're put on because of the schedules of their kids is actually kind of a gift in disguise because they get hyper-focused during those hours instead of feeling like, I've got all the time in the world.
Oh, absolutely. And I've said this on another podcast, but there's many artists and some interviews I've listened to recently where artists will specifically set up parameters for their work. I'll only work in this size, or I'll make one piece per day, and I'll only work in these certain colors. And those are completely valid. And I think being a mom and an artist puts those same kind of constraints on your work. And so it's just about like thinking in a positive light. You know, like for me, my studio hours are 9 to 3. And by 2 o'clock, I'm really on the go. I'm really in the midst of something. And sometimes it's hard to stop at 3 to go do carpool. But I really try to think of it as a positive light, that just that's the constraints on my work. And what I get made in that time is all I'm going to get made. And I think you do get, yeah, you just get on the ball quicker and you don't dawdle as much to make the most of that time. So
can you tell me, was there a moment or a decision that you made in your career that you feel like was a personal success for you? That's, you know, something that you're, when you look back on it, you just feel really proud of that decision, whether you knew at the time or not, it was a good decision.
Well, I definitely think having kids was a great decision. I think it's kind of, it's unspoken, but yet it's still somewhat preached that you have to choose between being an artist and being a mom. And I really feel like having kids informed my work. There's no way I would be doing this work that I'm doing now if I hadn't have had kids. If you want a more practical application, I would say, I think I had 2 little kids and I was pregnant with my 3rd, so I'm not quite sure what year that would be. But I just felt compelled to write to Chuck Close and say, you know, I'm making this work. I'm a mom in St. Louis. I didn't try to like, you know, put a giant resume and puff myself up. I kept it really real and honest and wrote to him and said, I just think there's something about my work that would resonate with you. Didn't really expect him to respond, but 2 weeks later he called me and, you know, said, if you're ever in New York, come to New York. I'd love to see your work. And so my husband and I flew up there. Now, I know in this day and age, there's a different, more enlightened opinion of Chuck Close that has changed over the years. But for me, I felt that was a success because I really believed in this work. I really believed it had potential. And even though nothing came of it, I mean, you know, he didn't recommend me for any grants. He didn't tell anyone about me. But for me, who didn't have gallery representation, you know, was a mom with 2 kids, pregnant with my 3rd, it was just validation that I was on the right track. So like I said, it didn't lead anywhere, but it definitely gave me confidence that someone like him, who I had, you know, studied his work in school and felt like a kindred spirit with his work, kind of allowed me to keep making, even though no one was interested in showing my work.
That's huge.
Yeah.
That's enormous. Do you remember what it felt like when you wrote him? Like when you're first like sitting down and going, okay, I'm going to write Chuck Close. And you're like sitting there literally going, dear Chuck Close.
Well, I was actually embarrassed for myself that I was doing it, but I just wrote to his gallery and said, if I had to, you know, get something to Chuck Close, how do I do that? And, you know, didn't even tell my husband I was writing, but just, again, I just really felt like there would be something about my work that would resonate with him. And yeah. So, and I said, I didn't puff myself up. I said, my resume is this tiny, I don't have gallery representation. I kept it really honest. Yeah. And so he's kind of, you know, followed my work. And just to know that someone thought I was on the right track was enough to kind of keep going till I, you know, got gallery representation and started showing and stuff like that. So
how did you go from not necessarily this experience with Chuck Close, but there you are, a mother, pregnant, and trying to get your work out? What did you do to get your work out? How did you approach getting exposure for yourself?
Well, one, I was just making the work. I'm almost grateful that like Instagram didn't exist back then, because I think there's so much pressure to get your stuff out there and share it before it's ready to be shared. And so I love that by not having gallery representation, you actually have all this freedom to do whatever you want. And the internet had just started. And so I started looking at a couple galleries, and the gallery that I'm with in New York, which is Lion's Weir Gallery, represented, I can't think of the artist's name, but at the time he knitted these superhero outfits. And they also represented painters. So I kind of thought to myself, well, if they represented him and considered that, you know, on par with painting, they would probably consider my work painting, which is what I was really looking for, is someone not to consider it fiber work. Clearly it is fiber work, but I wanted it to be taken seriously as painting, which they did. And I've been with them ever since. So.
You know, I have this really vague memory, and I don't know if it's real or not, but I remember a lot, like in the early 2000s, I feel like it must have been, or definitely like 2005 at the latest, I feel like. Were you ever in, what is that magazine? Is it New American Paintings? I remember reading.
I read
that. Oh my gosh, that's so funny. I remember sitting there looking at it, looking at your work. And thinking, and I remember the story about you being pregnant and doing this, you know, because you wanted an alternative to, having paints in your studio. It's so funny because I am now just kind of remembering, like, sitting there holding that magazine and reading about you. This is so funny.
Yeah. And that was a big thrill to be in that. I think I've constantly looked for opportunities where the work is taken seriously, and it's, I mean, not that painting is the hierarchy of art forms, but I definitely wanted it to be seen differently. And so being in New American Paintings was really exciting for me at the time, to be shown next to all the painters. And then having my show at the Contemporary Art Museum in St. Louis. So that's a biennial event they have here in St. Louis, where three local artists are allowed to propose an exhibition, and then you get your first museum solo along with $20,000 to put on your exhibition. And another reason that was, you know, I had applied to it every time and been rejected. But when I was finally accepted and was able to put on my exhibition, it was that same kind of feeling. You know, at a quick glance, my work can look very traditional. Or if I describe to people, oh, I stitch portraits of family. I mean, instantly you conjure up some horrible image that is nothing like my work. So I'm very grateful to the Contemporary for giving me that opportunity, because I really needed my work to be on a white wall in that beautiful space to allow people to treat it seriously. And yeah, I don't know how to finish that sentence, but
well, yeah, to take it seriously and to show it, you know, like in a,
well, it's for it to be modern, I think, because it can so quickly. I mean, I think a lot of people's work is like that. If you don't really take the time to look at it, you can easily dismiss it and put it into a certain category. So I've had little moments like that, like being in New American Paintings and having that exhibition, that someone gave me the opportunity to be alongside other artists or in a space that allowed my work to be viewed in a way that I wanted it to, which is really exciting.
Very exciting.
Yeah.
And also, like, it makes a big difference to see. I kind of think of it as, you know, you have your little children in your studio, and then, you know, like these exhibitions, they're all dressed up and your paintings are sort of presented in their finest. And so when they're given the space to breathe and they're not stacked up against a wall and they're displayed in the way that, you know, you intended them to be, and it really sort of catapults them into a whole different level. So just the opportunity to have that experience in that place.
Right.
So kind of on the flip side of that, I would love it if you could tell a story of a time when maybe you were experiencing a particularly challenging time or a challenging moment, and more importantly, what you learned from that, what you took out of that, how you resolved the issue.
Sure. So I love to look for mistakes in my studio. I love to look for accidents. I love to look for failures. I think failure is the closest link right next to creativity than success. I think if you're riding on success, that's great, but I think it stifles an artist's creativity. So I always think that like every artist dreams to be successful, but yet we dread it at the same time because we know you could be put in a position where you're forced to make the same kind of work. You know, you're not allowed to have the freedom to experiment. So looking back, like the work with this embroidery work that I've done, I think the most pivotal point or the biggest accident was I typically do portraits of people with their mouth closed. And one portrait, I let her mouth be slightly open. So it showed her teeth. Clearly, I know that teeth aren't white, that they are a myriad of colors to make them appear white. So I stitched them. They were wrong. I pulled them out. And I don't typically rip out my stitches. I either keep going or just I know from the first stitch this is wrong and I'll pull it out. I had to rip it out a second and a third time. And the fourth time there was so much pressure and I was actually like the structure of the linen underneath had been so compromised by me pulling out so much that I knew this is it. This is the last chance. The whole portrait was done. So I sent it off to the exhibition and because I'd worked it so much, the mouth area appeared like buck teeth. And I was like, oh my, like I walked into the gallery. I was like, oh my gosh. And it had a little bit of like side light from a window nearby. Anyway, made it through the exhibition, but I just knew I have to recall that piece. And it was sad because the rest of the piece was, I really loved it. Anyway, so I had it in my studio. I couldn't even look at it. So I had it turned around. A couple of years later, I was getting ready for another exhibition. So because I'd always been looking at this back image, which was really cool, it showed the not only the sewing, but it had showed my attempts to try and pull the embroidery back in, hopefully, so that it wouldn't be quite so bulging on the front. And I thought, this back image is way more interesting. I'm just going to stretch it in reverse, put it in a two-sided frame, put it on a pedestal. And by doing that, then the real side of the embroidery was kind of in a shadow box. So you didn't have the light coming at it. It didn't look like bucktooth or whatever. But this backside was actually the most interesting. And it was the first piece to sell in the exhibition. So it was an obvious, obvious failure. And it took distance from the making of the piece to actually see the beauty in this mistake. And so I think that's how I approach my studio practice now is to constantly keep my eyes open for either, you know, mistakes that I make or keeping my eyes open constantly to these kind of what I think are nothings and how they can actually, like that particular piece completely changed the trajectory of my studio practice. And that's why now I do the front images, I paint the back images, or I, you know, show them on pedestals so you can see them in the round. And again, it was a big fat failure that I was able to turn in this other direction. And personally, it feels a lot of times I think I can feel that, you know, I make portraits of family and how is my work relevant in the grander scheme of the art world? And I think there's very valid things in the art world that are taking the stage right now, things that very much should be center stage, like discussions about politics and religion and, you know, sexual identity and the Me Too movement, the Black Lives Matter movement. All these things are rightly so should be discussed in art. And oftentimes I feel like, oh, do my portraits of family, you know, play into that? And it, for me, a lot of times it comes back to this back image. It's the side of people that we don't see. It's the side of people that holds love and hate. It could hold wounds and scars. It can hold anxiety and depression. It can hold joys and highest, you know, peaks of someone's life. But it's also the side that either you show no one or you show everyone. You know, there's different degrees of how much people let them see this other side. And so I think in that way, and I know I just posted something yesterday, just I can't get these recent deaths that have been in the news of these celebrities out of my brain. And I keep thinking, you know, this is very much this other side because we can't see it. We don't know what people are going through. We look for signs. And so in that respect, I feel validated that, you know, I do need to continue on this path in what I'm doing, that whether it appears relevant on the surface, it's very much connected to a lot of issues that are being talked about today. And it would not be authentic for me to diverge from this path that I'm on. But I'm very grateful to this other side that I discovered in my work, because I think that's the side that kind of can touch on all these issues that are being talked about today, which is exciting.
That is really exciting. That's interesting because I just spoke last night with Diana Carvel, who's doing, I had never heard of this, but in the Victorian era, people would exchange like these mini portraits of their, of just their eyes or just one eye. And it was sort of a, you know, way for people to like carry somebody with them, but not, but have it be relatively anonymous. So what she's been doing is in a way very similar in the sense that she's talking with regards to the Me Too movement. She was started to wonder, like, if I were to ask women in my close friends and family, if they've experienced this, what percentage would say that they had experienced something? So her project that she's working on right now is she's doing these portraits of their eyes, but also along with it. And she does, they're incredibly detailed, and she does it on paper cutouts of doilies. And so there's this really feminine aspect to it, and it gives it a lot of space. And then she's telling, using their words to tell the story of what happened to them. And it's because they're able to do it in a sense anonymously, they feel safe enough to be rather explicit about what it was that they experienced. And it's really powerful. So it's reminding me a lot of what you're talking about. You have this face that you present to the public, or you present to even close family members. And if, you know, just thinking about Kate Spade and just this presentation of somebody who's, whether she intended to or not, to, you know, have it all together, that is, you know, everything's fine. And on the backside, clearly, she had some real, real struggles that she maybe felt like she couldn't show anyone.
Right. And I think it's interesting why we're all, like, clearly, you know, nobody knew her or Anthony Bourdain. But there's this human connection to know, we know people who struggle with similar issues. And I think there's that heart and that compassion behind just thinking about that. I like that that part of my work, I can reflect on those things. And I think the whole reason we make art as artists is when there's no words to describe what we want to say. And then I think is like the main purpose of art. And so when I show this other side or I depict it, I really just want to turn it around, but not really say anything, because I think people can come to that image from so many different places and make a connection to this other side that's knotted and messy and complicated. And yeah, I think so many people can come to that. And, you know, we're all human. All our other side looks exactly the same.
I love it. I think it's beautiful. I think it allows people to sort of empathize with the messy side when you realize that we all have it, and maybe be a little bit more sympathetic, and also at the same time not be quite so self-righteous in our own thoughts and opinions, because we all have that side to us, you know?
Right. And I think, like, not trying to hide it too, that there's actually beauty there in all the knots and the mess and the brokenness. There's still beauty. So it can be turned around and you can show people that other side.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it starts with a conversation. That's, and at least acknowledging that it's there, you know, like when I'm thinking about what you said about, you know, the hate and the, you know, and the anger and all that side. But when you can, if people were, I think, able to freely express that and sort of, and maybe it'll, and not maybe, it would definitely be ugly and awkward and et cetera, but I think that would be the only way that people can come to an understanding, was to have those difficult conversations. So yeah, I can see like so much in that concept of the backside and the messiness and the knots in it.
Mm-hmm.
Where would you like to take your work next? So you just finished this. Sounds like a pretty substantial project that you're finishing up.
Yes. So I went on a self-imposed art maternity leave for a month, because I feel like putting on an exhibition is really like having a baby, and you need some time to recharge. And I was putting in like 10 and 11 hour stitch days right towards the end. And so I wanted to take this summer to take a break, be with my family, but also give myself some time to experiment. And, you know, I've had some ideas bouncing around in my head. So I'll just kind of work slowly this summer. I think I want to get back to the big verso pieces. So I haven't done one of those in maybe like over a year and a half. So because I've been doing so much of the realistic front portraits, I'm excited to get back into the painting studio. So what I'm thinking is I want to take the best of what I love about the painting, and I want to take the best of what I love about the sewing and somehow find a way to put those into a giant piece where they work side by side. And I haven't figured that out. So I sat up there the other day for 2 hours just staring and trying to think how I could do that. Yeah, so it'll be some version of that, I think.
Nice. And I really appreciate the fact that you give yourself those periods of rest to reflect after something bit, you know, like a big show like that. And also to just sit there and stare off into space for 2 hours and give yourself the time and space to connect dots and to, you know, allow whatever thoughts you're having about where you're going to go next to percolate and expand.
Right, right.
It's, I think so many people that I talk to, artists and students, somehow feel a little bit guilty like about that. And it's essential.
I think, yeah, you do feel a little bit guilty. But at the same time, again, I think you're always thinking in your head, you're driving in the car. You know, my kids have been busy in their studios this summer, and, you know, I glean ideas from them or we do stuff together.
Your kids are artists?
They each do their own kind of art. So they're all like, they all kind of were like cleaning up their studios or, so my kids range in age from 9 to 17. So it's not as easy, you know, in the summer to say, okay, we're going to do Play-Doh for an hour. So I just kind of have a designated time where I take away any screens or technology. And I say, you need to go create for 3 hours. I don't care what you do, you draw, you can read, you can paint, you can write, and they're all have their different interests. So that's kind of exciting. But also, yeah, I think, you know, your studio isn't just when you're in your studio. It could be you're getting color inspiration from a Vogue magazine that you're looking through. It could be anything. And so, yeah, I'm hoping this summer just recharges me to give me more direction when they go back to school.
Mm-hmm. I love it. You mentioned that, you know, just flipping through magazines and allowing your studio to be anywhere, but I'm curious, like, where, what do you do or where do you go when you are just wanting to refresh your eyes, I guess, or get inspiration or just, I kind of think of it as watering these plants.
Yeah. Well, I'll be honest, I'm not a big reader. So every once in a while, I'll pick up a great biography that will be really inspiring. And there's such a parallel between, obviously, I do portraits of people. So, you know, once I get a good biography, I devour it. And my kids are always saying like, yes, because reading's fun. And I'm like, I know, but I just have to find the right book.
I love it that your kids are trying to convince you to read. That is awesome.
So I think I find myself, well, Instagram is a big source of inspiration and a big distraction, but I find myself returning to some of the same artists that I maybe followed back in undergrad. And it's so interesting to see what their artwork looks like now. So in undergrad, I was really into Chuck Close, Lucian Freud. When I went to grad school, I was into Elizabeth Peyton.
Mm-hmm. Oh, God, I loved her work.
Right. And so actually, I didn't love her subject matter, but there's something about the way she painted, the supports that she used. She actually came to our grad school and gave a talk, and then she had an exhibition at the St. Louis Art Museum when I was in grad school. So I got to see the work up close. And so now I'm obsessed with Alex Katz, who is someone who I was not interested in undergrad. Like, we studied him and I was like, I don't know. I thought it was a little bit boring, but I think that I've listened to a couple talks with him and he said, the art world has finally caught up with me. And I'm like, yes. Like, I just am so in awe of what he produces. Like, his work is better than ever. I think he's 90. And so I find that the greatest source of inspiration. There's also some female artists that are at the top of their career, or maybe they've just been discovered, like Rose Wiley. I think she's in her 80s.
I don't know her work.
So her work's, she's British, and she's, her work's very abstract, but she was like a mom. She was an artist, and a mom raised her kids, and kind of the art world just recently took notice of her in her 80s. And so I find things like that very inspiring. And again, so now I'm looking at, you know, how Elizabeth Payton's work has evolved since, I think I was in, wait, I graduated in, so 20 years ago was when I graduated from grad school. And I find that very inspiring to revisit those artists.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. What are some of the habits that you have that you feel like really contribute to your growth as an artist?
I definitely think making. Making, whether you have an exhibition, whether you have the promise of exhibition, just sheer time in the studio. I mean, I've heard lots of people say that on podcasts, but it is so true. You know, you can think of what you want to make in your head, and you can think through all the steps, but until you actually start moving paint around, start squeezing the clay, start chiseling, you know, whatever your art practice involves, you don't know where that path's going to lead to a mistake, which may be then lead to something that's even greater than you could have ever imagined. So even in the embroidery work that I do, there's a big difference from the work that I was making 16 years ago. They're much more detailed, they're kind of obsessive level of detail, but there's also a confidence there because I know what my medium can do. And, you know, some parts I can throw in effortlessly. And then, you know, some parts still make me nervous. Like I told my husband the other day, I'm working on a piece now. I said, I just finished 10 large scale embroideries and I'm back onto the mouth and the nose area of a new piece. And I said, I'm scared to death. I'm like, I'm going to wreck it. I'm going to wreck it. So there's that in just the doing, I think there's so much wealth of knowledge that you gain. And then you can see the growth in your work, you know, from year to year, which is great.
Yeah, I think it's feels almost too simple maybe to some people, or there's just something that holds us back when we're feeling that way of like every artist experiences that where it's just, oh my God, I'm going to wreck this. This is too good to be true. I didn't, you know.
Right.
Somehow I made a mistake and this painting came out well. So if I touch it again, it's going to like completely destroy it.
And there is that line. I mean, I think that's a reality is like, you know, oh my gosh, I can take it too far. And then, you know, I set myself up for failure every time I do the shirt, then I do the hair, then I do the forehead. All these parts are easy for me. And the hardest part that causes me the greatest stress, I always save till last. Like if I would just get it out of the way, maybe in the beginning, but, and my husband's like, why do you do that? I'm like, I don't know. But maybe that's a good thing. Maybe that you're walking that tightrope of failure and success.
Yeah. It's almost like you just need to, I don't know, do a series on mouths so that you kind of like get to experience that of like over and over and over again of facing the fear.
Well, I think that's why we all make the next piece is because, you know, you're on to the next piece because you thought the piece you were making would fulfill everything you were hoping for. And you're left with still more things that you know you can discover and investigate. And then you make another piece and then you make another one. So
yeah, and you're always bringing something over.
Right. Each piece definitely informs the next, I think.
Mm-hmm. What advice would you give to yourself, the artist that you were, let's just put it at 20 years ago, that Casey who was fresh out of grad school and just starting out?
Well, I've heard you ask this to other people, and you always say 10 years. So I was like prepared for 10 years ago. What would I tell myself? So now you've thrown me for a loop.
Okay. How about, let's do this then. How about tell me 10 years ago, and then is it different for the 20 years?
Okay. So 10 years ago, I would tell myself the art market is going to crash. So it was 2008. I had just started working with Lions Weir in New York. They were going to Pulse New York and they took two of my embroideries. This was the height of the art market. They sold in the first 10 minutes. Well, they're actually like put on a reserve. There were people like listed below those people who wanted the two pieces. My dealer was calling me and saying, can you, you know, overnight some more work? But I was in Florida on vacation, so I couldn't. So there was this like excitement because this was all very new to me, but no one knew this was the height of the art market and was about to crash. So we scheduled my first solo exhibition in New York for 2009, and it was just crickets, absolutely crickets, like nothing sold. And so in a way, that was a good thing because it took off all the pressure. You know, I was still a young mom, and it allowed me to, well, just get back into the studio, start making work. And I think if I went back 20 years, advice to myself, I would just say, yeah, you're going to start doing embroidery.
Like, just kinda, embrace like, it.
Yeah, wrap up the painting. I know it sounds gross, but you're going to, yeah, start stitching again. I think I never would have expected it. But I think part of me 20 years ago would have been happy to know that this search that I've been on in my whole artistic path has always been a way to try and merge craft and art. And I think now's a great time, or it's been better than ever, for people to include things like woodworking and stitching and glass in their work. But I think it's always been frowned upon.
Why do you think that's different now?
I just think there's more artists who are including it in a really interesting way. Well, for instance, there's this one artist I follow. His name's Brent Wadden, and he does these very simple abstract tapestries. And I've seen some of them at Art Basel in Miami. And they, you stare at it and you're like, that is a painting. There's clearly no paint, but it has the power and the presence that transcends beyond, you know, the hashtag of tapestry that you would see on Instagram. It just, I don't know if it's the scale or the simplicity, but they are so powerful. They're so painterly. And I find that really exciting when the art world accepts it and they don't really realize what they're accepting. I had tried several failed attempts of ways to include craft in my works. I was always a really crafty kid. And I feel like this embroidery work is the closest that I've ever gotten to merging those two worlds. So I've always wanted my work to be about the portrait as well as the process. So people who maybe weren't into portraiture were still intrigued by how the work was made. Yeah. So I think I would definitely 20 years ago, I would plant the seed of excitement that like I was going to stumble upon something that would get me even closer to that goal. You know, I think if I was a man making this exact same body of work right now, I would probably have a lot more people interested in the work, but I'm a woman doing traditional woman's work, which I think, you know, traditionally the art world, that's kind of expected maybe. And it just takes, again, someone to give the work a spotlight, to put it on a white wall with a cement floor, to take it beyond the fact that this is a woman doing
stitching.
Right. And I kind of like that my parents named me Casey because it is a very gender neutral name. And I do love that some people don't know if I am a man or a woman making this work.
That's really interesting. I was talking to Cameron Schmitz like a month or so ago. She's an artist that I interviewed early on in the podcast, but she was telling me that her mom actually gave her and her sister gender neutral names for that reason.
That's interesting.
Yeah. And I thought that was both brilliant and terribly sad.
Well, I know my parents just like the name, but I think it's just interesting people who think like, oh, wow, they'll comment on Instagram and say, check out this guy's work, you know, and I'm like, well, and I think that does it get read differently if they think it's a guy doing it? Is there a different read if they know I'm a woman? It's just interesting, I think.
Yeah, it is. It is really interesting. And it's the other thing I think that is just fascinating is the ratio of female art students to male art students. It's, I mean, like female art students outweigh male art students drastically. And it's the opposite in galleries and museums.
Yeah, I don't know what the statistics are as far as like students.
First, yeah, I don't know what the exact statistics are, but it's heavily weighted towards women. But I know in art museums, at least about 7 or 8 years ago, it was like only 5% of the work was female artists in museums. I'm sure that's different in galleries, but I still think it's skewed.
Right. And I also feel like, you know, you could sit and, like, as a woman artist, I could sit and pout about that and I could crab about it. But I think ultimately your job as an artist is just make your work and make it to the best of your ability. And when it's time, the right people will see it, you know?
Yeah, there's some danger in there of not wanting to push through the work that you need to do, like we were talking about earlier, and falling back on the reasons being other than you didn't push through on your work.
Right.
Yeah, there's a lot there. There's real stuff and there's on both ends of that of like, you've got to do the work. You've got to push through. You've got to like really apply yourself and, you know, put the 10-hour days in your studio embroidering to understand how those threads are going to work together. And then there's the other side of it of, yeah, there's the male female thing is real.
Right.
But anyway, we won't solve that on this podcast. I think those are things that we need to be aware of and then get back to work.
Yeah. It just comes down to, yeah, make great work, you know, and if it happens, it happens. If not, I mean, it's a lifelong commitment and it has to give you joy to make it regardless of any recognition. So I'm content to keep making it and being a mom.
So last question for you, because I love the fact that you have several budding artists in your home. What advice would you give to an artist who is just starting out?
Well, besides just putting in the work, I would say get an Instagram account to get inspiration, but really, really, really try not to feel the compulsion to post every day. I just think that could squash your output and the discoveries that you're making in the studio. Don't shock. Do not try and shock. I think shocking is the easy route to making work. You know, I don't hashtag my stuff embroidery or any. I did in the beginning, but I quit hashtagging it. But periodically, I'll check back into those hashtags and you'll check embroidery. Inevitably, there'll be like people cross-stitching swear words or anatomy parts. And I just feel like even if that had a moment, it's over. I think the best art is when you take really boring subject matter and try to find beauty in that, in the ordinary. And that is really, really hard to do. Now, not everyone wants to paint still lifes or portraits or that type of thing. But I think if your goal is to shock, to get attention or get followers or get hype, I just think that doesn't have the staying power that just a really well-made work of art has. There are people that shock. I love the work of Tracy Emin. And I think before I really knew about her work, I was turned off like, oh, she's just trying to shock people with her art. And that turned me off. But the more like talks that I've listened to with her and her work, I realized she's actually so honest. She's not hiding anything. And that's why it comes across as really shocking. And I think that is different.
The intention is different.
I think it is different. I think, you know, she's had a hard life. She's been very vocal about things in her life, mistakes that she's made, just her life. And I think by, you know, the way she shows her work, there's some parts that are like shocking. There's lots of artists that make work. And I think it's different because it comes across as shocking. But there's people who make work just to shock, to get attention. And that's what I would tell young artists, don't do. Because it's easy, it's quick, it doesn't have staying power. But show me a painting of an apple that is so amazing that I can't quit looking at it. And I mean, you know, I don't even want to paint an apple, but I think that is more difficult. So yeah, don't shock.
Is that a Matisse? Somebody said that.
Really?
About, yeah, specifically about show me, making your exact point. Which, you know, it's great. I think I'll look for it. It's
okay.
And I'll send it to you. I think it was Matisse, but I'm not sure. Yeah, show me a well-painted apple and I'll show you blah, 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 something about an artist. I'm going to find it. I'll find it and send it to you.
Yeah, It's harder. It's way harder to do.
Mm-hmm. It's harder to... simple is hard.
Right.
Casey, thank you so much for being on the show with me.
You're welcome.
Well, I hope you enjoyed this episode with Casey Zavaglia as much as I did. Go to savvypainter.com and click on the podcast tab. You'll find show notes there along with examples of Casey's work and links to all of the artists that we mentioned in this episode. The Savvy Painter Growth Studio is an ongoing community and mentorship program for hardworking artists who are diligently honing their craft and wanting to learn how to promote and sell their art. Growth Studio is a place for artists to hone their skills and discover who they are as an artist in a supportive community. It's a place where artists can get honest feedback from their peers, trade ideas, and ask the burning questions that pop up when we're trying to get to the next level with our art. The questions you want to ask but feel silly because you mistakenly believe that a real artist would know this. Like, how do I develop a series? How do I price my work? How do I talk with my gallery about getting what I need and want out of the relationship? Wait, you even have a gallery? I want to know how to even find one. Growth Studio gives you hands-on experience to help you master your painting skills and learn how to run an art business. We also dig deep into what makes you tick so that what you create as a painter and an entrepreneur fulfills you and fits your life design. It's not a program that you just coast through, and you'll get your fair share of tough love, but the results are worth it. One of my students, Ginger, says, "I originally signed on because I wanted to become a more effective business person, and I have. But I didn't expect it to be a roller coaster and a challenge and a joyous discovery process. I didn't expect to form such close personal bonds with artists from all over the world." If that sounds like a program that you can thrive in, applications to Growth Studio are now open. Go to savvypainter.com/workshops to learn more and to apply.